She twines her spines up slowly towards the boiling sun. And when I touched her skin, my fingers ran with blood.
Hello and welcome to the Nattercast for True Detective Season 1, part one of our two-part coverage of True Detective. I'm Jason Shankle of Shankle Studios, and I'm here with my task force. Say hello, task force.
Hello, everybody.
Hi.
Hello.
And we're here tonight to natter at you about True Detective, which was just quite a wonderful little treasure that we had this spring. Before we get into our recaps and our coverage, let me just tell you who we are. We are the Nattercast. You can reach us at www.nattercast.com. And you can send us an email at nattercast@gmail.com. And where all of the excitement really is for us is on Facebook. If you go to Facebook, to www.facebook.com/groups/nattercast, you'll find our Nattercast group where people are there talking about not just True Detective, but The Americans and Walking Dead and The Good Wife. And got Game of Thrones coming up. It's going to be awesome. And also, if you just go to www.facebook.com/nattercast, you'll find our Nattercast page, and we'd appreciate it if you would like us there. That gets us a little more visibility, and that's where a lot of our announcements come out and things like that. And also, if you're listening to us on iTunes, please, please, please hit us with a 5-star review. We got a couple of good, nice 5-star reviews this last couple week or two, and that's the best thing you can do for us to get us a little more visible on iTunes and bring more listeners in. So, but this, tonight we are doing True Detective, and let me just tell you, I mean, holy shit, internet. we were trying to get a little more audience for our podcast. We're a humble little cast, you know, and we have people listening to us, and we said, let's go out and see if we can drum up some business on True Detective, get some people interested in Nattercast, and boy, did you guys arrive. We set up this group. There's a whole separate group if you're a regular Nattercast listener. Called I Can't Stop Watching True Detective that we set up because we found Siona.
Yeah, I just one night we had just finished watching it and we're like, we gotta just, and he goes, can we continue? And I go, of course. And I just stood up there and said, we can't stop watching this.
And we couldn't.
So that's, we made the group.
We made that group and we got like 600 people in before the end of the show. We're at 650 people in there now. We got like 50 people who have joined since the show is over.
It was almost like we weren't even there. People just showed up and started having a party around us.
Big party.
Talking with each other, forming ideas and clubs, and they're doing all kinds of stuff.
They're submitting everything they can possibly find.
Gotta have been at least 6 weddings by now.
Yeah, seriously. Conspiracy theories.
It was great.
There's new little offshoot groups. We met some great Natter people who came in to join the Natter group. And the Natter group's gotten a lot more lively. You know, because we got so much new blood out of this. So this show's really done well for us. So we have to say thank you to Nick Pizzolatto, affectionately known as the Pizza Latte, for helping us really boost our cast and boost our audience.
Yeah, cheers,
and making
Nick.
A good show.
And making a great show.
Right.
Well, it was such a cerebral show. I think people liked that, liked the psychological makeups of these two very different characters getting thrown together.
Absolutely.
And yeah, it spawned a ton of conversation. It was really cool.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And once it got into like Yellow King and Robert Chambers and just
the literary references.
Yeah. And the acting, and so we actually want to, I think I want to start off with a little listener feedback because we had so much activity and the listener feedback, normally I just go and I gather listener feedback and we get enough for the show and that's kind of it. There was no hope of gathering all the listener feedback for this. We just I actually went into threads and I made targeted questions to try and focus people. So we have our first question.
So basically we have the listener feedback into two sections here.
Yes.
And the first section is, when were you first hooked? And I'll just say for myself, it was the credits.
Yeah.
And then I was pretty hooked. And I'm like, oh, these are good credits. And then as soon as he started, like he's doing his little cigarette beer thing, he's sitting there and he's starting to speak as if he might have an IQ. I was like, that's it. I'm done. I got to see this.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Please don't fail me. This is, I'm so hooked. And I said it out loud. I was on the couch and went, oh, I am just so in.
Yeah. I think I was in about 7 seconds in.
Yeah. It was really quick for both of us.
Yeah, yeah.
We were both looking at each other. We're in.
We're in. Yeah.
And so we have from one of our listeners, Kim Sheriff. I was hooked from the moment Rust started his initial theory of the universe while driving in the car with Marty. That's when I realized that this is going to be a very different type of procedural, one with a lot more depth. And a nice long one from Stephanie Brown Anderson. It was Matthew McConaughey that hooked me. Rust Cole fascinated me from the minute he opened his mouth. I remember watching the premiere and being completely hooked by the end of the first scene of Rust with Gilbo and Papina. The bit with the cigarettes, his gestures, facial expressions, and tone captivated me. That's the stuff I'm a sucker for. The second thing that grabbed me was the shot at the crime scene of Marty walking in front of that row of cops sent out to help with the search. Then they panned over to Russ standing alone next to Dora. It was clear at that point that this show was carefully done and ripe with meaning and symbolism. I knew it was going to be a smart show that had respect for its audience. And the name Dora Lange, it immediately made me think of Dorothea Lange. I liked that. It gave the impression that Nick P. Pizzolatte was going to tell us a story of a depressed people and a place, and we would be introduced to this place, these people, their lives, through the story of Dora, just as we saw the lives of the people fleeing the Dust Bowl through the lens of Dorothea Lange.
Interesting point.
Yeah, very good. Now, we got a letter last week that Dora Lange was a real person, that this was based on a real event.
So I looked into this. I don't know about the name Dora Lange. Somebody said that this was the name, but there were a couple of killings where the bodies were found in sugar cane fields. One in 79 and one at some other point. Neither of them were set up like this or had any of this element to it. It was just they were found in sugar cane fields. And somebody said that they remembered that one of them was named Dora Lange, but
But was it Erath? Erath is the name of the town, right?
Yes, it was. This is in Erath, Louisiana.
Okay.
Right, absolutely. So, alrighty. So let's, how are we going to do this? So we want to be a little more loosey-goosey on these things, So I've got a little bit of audio from the show to kind of introduce each of the chapters, and then we're going to kind of go around and just talk about the first four chapters tonight on this episode, and you can get the second four, the back half. On our next one. So let's hear a little bit of True Detective.
Can you tell us anything about that, Mr. Cole?
Yeah, it looks a lot like the one from 95. Well, you knew that already.
Yeah, there's specifics consistent to the 95 case. Details, they weren't public knowledge.
You were off the grid for 8 years, right? Show back up here 2010.
My question is,
how could it be him? If we already caught him in 95. How indeed, detectives?
I figured you'd be the one to know.
Didn't start asking the right fucking questions.
Classic. And that was pretty much hooked. I was definitely hooked.
Yes. That nailed it. That had me going, wee! Yeah.
Wee! Okay, so let's talk a little bit about the first episode, shall we? And we'll get back to a little more of our feedback in a bit. So, we start off the show and we see this, sort of lumbering figure dragging a body through the sugarcane fields, right? And the lights on fire, and then we get to Rust and the introduction of Marty and Rust, and they're being interviewed 5 days apart, first Rust and then Marty. Mm-hmm. And we get the idea that these are two detectives who had...
I thought it was Marty and then Rust.
No, see, that's what everybody thinks. You see Marty first.
Oh. Mm.
But Marty's actually being interviewed after Rust. Oh. Rust gets interviewed first, because that's why Rust comes up later on and chases him down right after his interview, because he's already been interviewed at that time. And so right away, I like both of these guys, as characters anyway. Yeah. It's like, here's Marty's kind of like this good old boy who's sort of, and he introduces himself as very much a family man and a regular guy with a big ass dick.
Right. Yeah.
You know, and Rust is this sort of like burned out, crazed hippie surfer looking guy, you know, yeah.
skeletal looking
guy.
Yeah, Rust, you know, looks like he gave up just on life a long time ago.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The thing about, you see, you know, I pegged him to die in the first episode. I thought he was going to be dead. Once I knew that they were doing something dangerous, I thought he was going to die. Because he has a fatalistic attitude toward everything in the first place, and he just looked like hell.
Yeah.
You know, he chain smokes, he drinks too much, and that's all he does, and just be down on life in general.
Yeah, yeah. And that kind of hooked me in, too. It's like, here's a guy who's, you know... totally nihilistic, right? And then what I found fascinating is that we cut back to 95, and we see them, you know, looking at Dora Lang's case, right? And you see Rust, especially Rust, looks very different, mm-hmm. right? He's the tax man. He's got this big ledger, you know, and Marty's like, he came out of Texas. People thought he might have been a Fed. You know, he was aloof and he's kind of strange, you know, and everything like that.
Has a mysterious past.
He has a mysterious past. And then, and you're thinking, you're looking at Marty and you're saying, okay, this Marty looks like a guy who logically came from the 95 Marty. You know, mm-hmm. just he looked like an older version of that guy.
Yeah. Right.
But Russ looks like he's gone through a lot.
Yeah.
He looks like some heavy road.
As we will find out.
You know. And you get the idea that he's aloof. And then I found it was really interesting that he's, you know, they really set the idea that Rust is the intellectual and Marty's the, you know,
emotional.
More emotional or, you know, more of a straightforward cop.
Yeah.
And he says, you know, we had encountered a metapsychotic, you know. Mm-hmm. And I do a little research on this stuff and I know something about it. I've never heard metapsychotic. And I did a lot of looking and I found it in a couple places, but it's not really a term that people use,
mm-hmm.
you know. But what I found out was metempsychotic with an M means, or metempsychosis is a reincarnation into the body of an animal.
Oh.
Right.
Oh,
so that's, and as soon as I looked, I was like, while we were watching, I just Googled that. I'm like, I've never heard of metapsychotic. It's like, oh, metempsychotic means reincarnation to an animal. So that's when I knew they were doing layers here.
Because
uh-huh. you had the antlers and everything like that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, so Dora Lang is found in a field with sugarcane. She has a spiral on her back. We're getting all the basic clues here. You know, and there's these little bird cages made out of sticks. And Cole is right away, he's on serial killer. And the thing that made me like Marty right away is that he said, you know, instead of doing the usual sort of cliched thing of either completely shutting the idea down,
right.
you know, and calling him insane, or immediately embracing that they have a serial killer, he's like, you know, I didn't think of those books of yours about jumping to conclusions.
Yeah, right.
You know, and that's totally true. It's like, you know, jumping to conclusions. Yeah, okay. Let's see. All right, so then we're in the car on the way back. That was another great scene that I thought where, you know, it's like Marty explains to the detectives, you know, this is I should explain Marty's and Cole are being questioned in 2012 mm-hmm. about a crime that took place in 1995. And they'd been together for 3 months and had no conversations with each other or whatever. And, you know, Marty just picks this day to invite Cole to dinner.
Oh, he said he couldn't put the wife off any longer because the wife kept saying, "I've got to meet this guy. This guy's got your back. This is the guy who keeps you alive out there."
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. Right. And so,
and it doesn't go well.
It doesn't go well. But before they get to the dinners, then they're, you know, in the car, and Marty's kind of shaken by what they found, and you know, he asks Cole, you know, well, what do you think about life, right? And we started to get this life philosophy, basically that human intelligence is a tragic mistake, you know, and
we evolved too far.
We've evolved too far, and we're just these self-obsessed pieces of meat, you know. And
and the human race would be better off if it died off.
And is that when Marty made that great comment? Okay, how about the car be a place of quiet reflection?
Well, it's like 3 months I get nothing out of you, and today
now I get this.
And he's like, well, you asked. And he's like, I'm begging you to shut the fuck up.
Yeah.
You know, it is a cliche to have the mismatched partners.
Yes.
But usually one of them isn't like this.
Well,
usually one's a slob and one's neat or whatever.
You know, and I think this is something that was part of the strength of the show and maybe part of the weakness of it, especially toward the end, is it's very cliched, right? Mm. Very intentionally. It's a serial killer cop procedural, right? Mm. And then Pizzolatto was talking to Alan Sepinwall and said that he's not interested in serial killers, Right. And so I think the serial killer story doesn't interest him. He wants to do a story about cops and, you know, and their relationship. Mm-hmm. And the serial killer story is just the framing device for that character exploration. And I think that ultimately that was helpful because it gave us these great character interactions where he wasn't obsessing us on the procedure.
Right.
But in the end, you are telling a serial killer story, so you need to pay it off better.
Yeah.
Right. And it's like if Frank Darabont says, "I don't like zombies." Right. Well, you're doing it, or did, we're doing a zombie show, Frank. So.
Yeah.
Right. Let's see. So where? So
he calls himself. There's a nice moment. Marty's like, "Don't talk like when Russ is talking about religion and how he doesn't believe in anything, and Marty, don't talk about this around other people."
Yeah, it's like people around here don't think like. He's like, it's like I can taste the metal here, and I can smell the psychosphere. And then later on, they're going to interview somebody, and they come out, and he's like, "This is like a faded memory of a town that's being eaten up by the jungle." And he's like, "Stop talking like that." And that's the other thing that hooked me was the humor.
Yes,
yeah.
That was funny.
Just like Woody Harrelson's a great comedian.
He does it. He's right. The great good old boy.
He does a great good old boy.
He does a great ex, you know, serial killer. He does a great silly goofy guy working the bar.
Great hard ass.
Yeah.
Let's talk real quick about Matthew McConaughey though. I mean, did any of you guys have any idea that he was this good of an actor? Aside from, I mean, in general with Magic Mike and with Buyer's Club, the last couple of years.
He went through a period of just starring in dumb romantic comedies, but now he's had this sort of reawakening where he's actually making good movies.
I had
weird.
No idea he was that good.
No, I mean, I
that's what hooked me on the show, was just him being so goddamn good. I mean,
yeah.
Well, he's a great character.
Yeah, it didn't surprise me, because I saw elements of it before, because I've seen a lot of his work.
Mm-hmm.
And I really loved him in Magic Mike. It didn't surprise me. And also, from what I know of people who have the big machines and are really savvy about being, particularly the male actors who can play a lead or sidekick, which she can, there's a period when you're young, you go for the money grab.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And you don't take the meaty roles. You take whatever shitty little romance that will pay you millions of dollars, mm-hmm. little action films, whatever. And to us, we think, oh, well, he's making bad choices. He's not getting a lot of choices. He's getting maybe two choices, and he's picking the one with the bigger money. Because once that period of your life is over, it's done,
mm-hmm.
and then you can pick these meatier roles.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That's if you really want to own your stuff and build your own production company. He's playing, he is thinking, he even said it in his, a little bit, he alluded to it in his Oscar speech.
Right.
He's playing the long game, and there's mm-hmm. several actors who have done that, and they're the ones that make the bank. And then everybody's always surprised when they see them in meeting roles. It's they were like this all along.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It's just that it isn't like he's handed 20 scripts. Well, probably now he is, but you're not handed 20 scripts and like, well, here's one where you're going to be paid scale.
Oh, sure.
And cry a bunch.
Yeah.
Here's the one for $5 million.
You're lucky to get a toilet paper commercial.
Exactly. Right?
So,
exactly.
You take it.
So he really played it well, and I've seen him do little flavors of things and shift and change. So it didn't surprise me, but I was still in awe.
Yeah.
Mm.
But I was more in awe that somebody wrote a character that was that nuanced and dark.
Yeah.
But still sympathetic.
I loved the shot where he's saying that after getting invited to dinner, you know, that he just knew he was going to take a drink. And he's talking about his daughter.
Uh-huh.
You get the idea that his daughter's dead.
Right.
And he's just walking along the sugar cane, and his eye is right on the horizon, and it just guides to the horizon. He's just smoking and walking. It's like, I'm going to take a drink.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's like this fate that he's on.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, so the parts of the case unfold here. They investigate the disappearance of Marie Fontenot, who is a girl who was reported missing, and then the report was withdrawn because they believed she was with her father, taken with her father. Her mother pretty much abandoned her. And they talk to the sheriff about her disappearance and another girl who apparently saw the green-eyed spaghetti monster. Becomes mm-hmm. one of our big clues. Who is the
green-eared?
Oh, green-eared, green-eared,
green-eared
spaghetti monster, who was like a chased her through the woods or whatever. And so I'm like, okay, there's going to be some spaghetti monster.
That would have been kind of cool.
Let's put out an APB on spaghetti.
If it was Cthulhu, See,
that's what everyone was saying. Oh, it's going to be Cthulhu.
Yeah, right.
This, yeah, like not quite in this first episode, but by the third, people were like, "Oh, it's going to be a demon." It's like, oh, I don't think so.
Yeah, I don't think so. But I'm glad it did not take the supernatural.
Oh, thank God.
Yes.
I would have. So I would have just stopped watching.
Me too. I would have tuned out.
Yeah. Okay, and so then the other little bit here is Cole takes off on his own, and he interviews a couple of sex workers at a truck stop who might have known the. Known Dora Lang, and then he solicits one of them for pills for something barbital, because I don't sleep, I just dream.
Dark.
Do you speak all in Johnny Cash lines? I mean, what is
yeah, really. Apparently. Yeah.
So I get the idea that he's a drug addict and an insomniac, you know. And he doesn't mind buying drugs from his suspect. Okay, so there's the last couple of elements here. So we have Marie Fontenot, and they ultimately talk to her uncle, who's a former baseball player, has had a stroke, and they find a devil catcher in her shed. That's the end of that.
Mm-hmm.
That's the end of the episode. But before that, they find some mutilated cats at a black church, and Cole shows the Reverend sketches of the catchers, and we get the idea that this is a Santeria thing that his grandmother kind of used to do, have kids make these little devil catchers, that you know, kind of deal. And then we get to meet Reverend Tuttle, who is immediately everyone's prime suspect. It's like, because here's, I forget the guy, the actor's name.
He's so smarmy.
Yeah.
And he's a big named actor, right? And he's this minor character.
The actor's name, but. Yeah. And the way that he comes in, like, well, I think there's a war going on. Obviously, yeah, this is an anti-Christian crime. Like,
right. And so I got to say, I got immediately on the anti-Christian angle, I started thinking about the West Memphis Three, those kids who were, like, you know,
bulldozed
into because, Satanists killed these people. It's like, no, these little kids. It's like, they're not Satanists. B, Satanists didn't do it.
Right.
You know, and I started to see a lot of comparisons between sort of this satanic panic from the 80s and this period here.
Dora's ex-boyfriend, Charlie.
Charlie Lang.
Charlie,
that's
yeah.
right.
Yeah,
that's
he's
right.
Kind of
ex-husband.
Ex-husband.
Ex-Charlie Lang.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he says that Dora was, you know, he called her and she was like completely whacked out. Met a king, is going to be a nun, and so evidently she was a party girl and a little bit insane.
I liked Charlie.
I liked
did a really good job.
The actor did a great job with Charlie, I thought. But the big scene for the episode, though, before I move on, is I believe it's in this one, he comes to dinner drunk.
Right.
It's like after like 3 months, and it's like, you never come out drinking with the guys. You never have a drink with me. You have to get a load on before you come to my house. You know, and this is his daughter's birthday.
Right.
And Marty tries to say, okay, just come in 5 minutes, have a cup of coffee, and I'll call somebody and we'll get you out of here.
Right.
But then he doesn't take the out, you know, after he starts talking to Maggie about it.
Yeah.
And he tells Maggie about his daughter.
Right.
Dying when Marty's out of the room.
Because Marty didn't know about it till later, right?
Right,
exactly. And that's when Marty didn't know about it till later. This is when you see this can be a real edge to Cole.
Yes.
And also there's going to be some heavy drama in this thing where these guys are going to like lose their shit and everything. It's Bruce Altman who played the Reverend.
Played Tuttle.
So before we move on, let's we have a little more feedback on what got you hooked.
And there's another one from Sally Piccolo. The devil catchers hooked me. I kept looking for them in every scene and got caught. And then Irene Bailey Bird. When I saw Dora Lang's body, I thought this is going to be a damn good series. Sort of like the Green River thing with the women placed alongside the expressway so the drivers could see them. Then Douglas Joseph LaBarbera, when I heard the song Far From Any Road, I knew too. That song resonates through the whole hour show. No, actually, I can't get it out of my head. The Poison Creosote.
Absolutely.
Yeah, Poison Creosote.
That captures the show.
Totally, yeah. And then Ronnie Carlton. Good question. The fight between Maggie and Marty got my attention, but I guess it was episode 3, the whole monster monologue at the end. Yeah. And Solange says, I knew I was hooked 10 minutes in when Rust gives his mistake of evolution speech, because I agree, we are a virus. Also, when he capped it off with refusing to reproduce and opting out of a raw deal, I nearly stood up and applauded. I call my BFF immediately and basically bullied him into watching it.
Which I'm sure he was grateful for.
And last, Jackie Burgett. The preview intrigued me. And you know, Jack, that's a good thing you brought that up, because I remember seeing the preview like a month before, just in a flash. Uh-huh. And I went, oh, that looks really good. Yeah. But I knew I was going to like this, and Rust at the beginning of the interview went to light a cigarette, was told not to smoke, reaches for lighter, flips open, and says, don't be assholes.
Is that his first words on the show? Don't be assholes. Y'all want
to
hear
very close, yeah, yeah, to his first words. All right, well, before we jump into episode 2, we got a little more audio from the show to listen to. And it might have a little lead in, so I'm going to babble for a second while it plays. Here we go.
Let's cut to the point. As the crow flies, y'all are wanting to ask about that big throwdown in the woods. Yeah?
Eventually, sure. Right now, we're just trying to track the case.
Now, Cole worked it, especially.
Which indicates you think I'm too thick to realize that y'all are trying to jam somebody up. You're onto something new.
So Cole didn't want to give it to the task force. Did you?
No. I did not.
No.
All right, I'm going to hand over to, I believe, Mr. Gary. Are you number 2?
I get episode 2, and I love this episode. Not a lot happened in the story. We get the boys digging for, you know, more clues and more people to talk to. But I think this episode was really more about character development. We learn a lot more about their backgrounds, what kind of went into making them the guys that they are. They go to see Dora Lang's mom, who was played by Tess Harper.
Yeah.
Mm. What a lucky actress. Bit parts, but in two of the best shows ever. Breaking Bad, she played Jesse Pinkman's mom.
That's right.
And now she plays Dora Lang's mom.
Right.
So kudos to her. Great job. And we get a little family history on, you know, they're driving along and Marty was talking about his mom. He says, my mom was kind of the Donna Reed type.
Right.
You know, and for those who are younger, in fact, this is even before my time, Donna Reed was a TV mom in the 50s. Everything was perfect. House was perfect. She was perfect. Kids were perfect. It was the image that they were trying to, you know, pass off as.
You didn't break a sweat vacuuming.
Right, right. And you always looked fabulous, vacuum and heels.
I thought that was because women were magical back then.
Yeah.
Do I remember seeing that on a show?
Well, remember Bewitched?
Yeah, exactly.
That was the 60s, though.
Yeah, it predates Bewitched. But right, anyway, yeah. So Marty's mom is the perfect mom, which may give us a little insight into why Marty sees the world the way that he does. He sees the world as kind of there to serve his needs.
Right.
He alludes to that when he's in this fight with Maggie in the kitchen. You know, they're going at each other, and he says, you know, you're supposed to be here to support me and to help me, and, you know,
I
shouldn't have to...
I love that fight.
The fight was great, yeah.
It was well-acted, but again, kind of a cliche, almost every cop movie has a scene where the cop's wife says, you know, you aren't here for the family enough, and it's you don't understand the job. Well,
but those are Marty's excuses, though.
We see what he's really doing with his time.
Yeah, in this case, he's lying.
Not just that, but did you notice that he's accusing her of stuff that she wasn't doing?
Yeah.
He was accusing her of stuff that he was doing.
Mm-hmm. Right.
He kept saying, you're giving me this whiny, poor me bullshit when I have to look at dead antler ladies all day. Yeah. You know, so he's the one who's
whining. That was good.
And she... We never, I mean, maybe she did on the car on the way home, but we never hear Maggie complain on her own behalf, like, poor me, please pity me.
Right. It's she's not a wimp or whiny or bitchy at all.
But Marty is turning it on her.
He's turning his own.
He's projecting it. Yeah.
And there was something that happened that I noticed happened in a couple places. He used a scene from Heat. He comes up, he says to her, What do you want me to do? Tell you about the kid, the woman I found dead, and maybe I'll, through my talking to you, I'll have this catharsis. That line is straight out of Heat. Al Pacino threw that same bullshit at his wife.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, absolutely. And he does a couple more lines from Heat throughout the
Yeah.
Maybe Pizzolatto's just lazy.
Sorry. So we learned that Marty isn't quite the wholesome family man that he...
Yeah.
put himself out there to be in the first episode.
To be fair, did you see those tits?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Those were sculpted.
Out, this show shows more restraint than most HBO shows because it's episode two where we get the tits. So,
yes.
You know.
Yeah.
Like,
but,
my God.
And Russ pointed out later that she's like a young looking Maggie, though.
Right.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, those are some of the things that are going on with Marty. We know he drinks too much. And he passes it off as, I need to do these things for my family because of my work. This is how I let all that go so I can go home and be a good family man.
Right. He rationalizes
his
bad behavior.
So he excuses a lot of behavior for himself.
There was one bit back when Dora Lange's mother, this was one of the clues that people jumped on right away, is we see a picture of Dora from, it must have been the mid-80s, surrounded by the Courier de Mardi Gras. Five guys on horses. Mm-hmm. And everybody throughout the whole series thought, five guys. Every time we saw five guys, it's five guys. That she was part of it, But I think she was just with the Courier de Mardi Gras.
Yeah, and then, and so Marty asks Rust about his mom. Is your mom still alive? And he says, maybe.
Maybe.
So we learned that, Rust's family life wasn't that good.
Mom left him with dad. Dad took him to
Alaska and mm-hmm. never got along with his dad anyway. Let's see. What else do I have written down here? Oh, yeah. Did you guys notice that they're in Rust's apartment and he has a mirror about the size of a quarter on his wall?
They said that was McConaughey came up with that.
And they really?
According to the Pizza Latte, McConaughey came up with this idea. It was a part of his method.
Yeah.
For Cole, it's very funny. Woody Harrelson says that he went really method with Cole. He was kind of he was edgy. He was an asshole,
uh-huh.
and he was standing looking in that little mirror, like a corner of a hologram, just to see one part of his eye.
Yeah.
And McConaughey had this long speech about how he transformed the different times of the character when he was older and when he was younger. He had to go to different headspaces and. And Harrelson said, all I did was take off my wig.
Yeah, and that's true. Woody was pretty much the same guy. Marty was the same same Marty, just older.
Right.
But I thought it's cool. I love when they do things like that and they never explain it in the show. You just see him looking mm-hmm. into it. And then there's a scene where Marty tries it. He's like, so what do I look in it with one eye?
Are you supposed to be able to see with both eyes or what?
Yeah. It reminded me a little bit of... why I love, I made a comment on the Facebook page about Quentin Tarantino, how why I love so many of his things that he does in Inglourious Basterds. Lieutenant Aldo Raine has this thick scar all the way around his neck, and they never explain it.
Right.
They never tell you why it's there or where it is, but it's there. And, that's makeup. That's hours in the chair and makeup. That's every day he has to get that put around his neck, so it's not accidental. It's not...
Evidently, he was saved from a hanging.
Yep.
Yeah.
That's what it seems like,
The Nazis were trying to hang him.
Yeah.
So, anyway, okay. He looks at the quarter in one eye, and we never get that explained. And, let's see, Marty talked about he excuses his good old boy lifestyle as, he's doing it for the family. And he says, you got to decompress in his interview in 2012. He's talking to these two other cops, and he's still excusing himself.
Well, he asks, either of you guys have an ex-wife? And the first guy's like, no, and the other guy's like, one. He's like, how many ex-wives do you have?
Yeah.
He's like, one. He's like, so you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Were mistakes made?
Yes.
Yeah, right.
Sure.
So then he has an affair with a hot young court stenographer, and that goes badly. Because he's obsessive about her. He can't possibly be in love with her.
Right.
He's the obsessive type.
Well, did you notice that he warns her that there are more bodies that they haven't told people about?
He's trying to get her to stay.
Well, one of the conspiracy theories. People were like, he knows about other killings, and he's not telling them. It's like, no, he's trying to scare her so she won't go out.
Yeah.
But it was one of those things where everything they did had kind of like there was a conspiracy interpretation, and there was a you know, innocent.
Ackman's razor really.
Oh yeah.
Came out true for this totally.
One thing that comes out is Russ tells the interviewers that he admits that he was drug trafficking for 4 years.
Yeah.
As undercover, which is amazing.
Mm-hmm. It's impossible.
Yeah, that's pretty much what they say. Yeah.
Right. But it was because he had they lost his daughter, right?
Right, yeah. And he went through.
And he killed the guy, the junkie.
He killed the dealer
for injecting
up his own daughter.
Right,
and so his choices were jail or
undercover.
UBR, undercover. Deep undercover guy.
And there ain't no. What do you say?
There's no expiration date.
Mm. There ain't no expiration date, baby.
And there, he was talking about it with Marty, and Marty said usually like 11 months is the most you would do that, and then you're wiped, you're done.
Right.
And this is, you know, more insight into why Russ is so damaged.
Well, have you seen Rush? Jennifer, the
yes.
Jason.
Oh, yeah.
Jennifer Jason Leigh,
yeah.
Jason Patrick?
No.
It's
based
a,
on true story.
Based on true story. Yeah. Oh, Gary.
Yes.
Oh,
right.
You got to see really Rush. Good. You got to see Rush.
Good music, too.
True story about two undercover cops, partners, who ended up falling in love while being on the job. But they were portraying boyfriend, girlfriend, dealers. And they keep trying to make a big deal. But it's like, you're coming in here asking to buy like $10,000 worth of coke in this little podunk town. Clearly, you're cops. You know,
yeah,
so
yeah.
They have all this trouble. And they're undercover for it's like 2 years.
And they become addicted.
And they become
drugs.
Addicted, and
right.
They go insane.
You know, drug dealers aren't stupid. They make them shoot
right
after buying to prove
right.
they're addicts. Like, ugh.
Right. So, anyway.
Okay, and then we have Russ still hallucinating because he's had brain damage from all the drugs he's had to do.
Yeah. I love that hallucination scene.
And there's
the hallucination scene is great. He's driving.
Scene where they're looking for a brothel and Russ just totally beats the shit out of these two.
Yeah, I'm coming to that.
Oh, sorry,
that's fine. The hallucination scene is great. He's driving his truck, and this is like the most attention we see him pay through the whole thing. His eyes
are
wide open, white knuckling the steering wheel, and his lips are.
That was a great acid flashback. It felt really... That's what it looks like.
With the tracers.
Well, that's what full-on being
that's
on acid
what it looks
like.
Really, Jason, please, tell us more.
Yes.
I understand from the literature.
I saw a movie where a guy had an acid flashback.
Well, not flashbacks. Flashbacks are kind of not real things. But the actual trip looks like that. Yeah.
So we also find out that Rust's files are still sealed.
Right.
And hence the Fed rumors, and they say, you want to talk about that? And he says, shit, why not? And that's when we find out about his background in the high-density drug traffic.
Yes, high-density drug trafficking area. Yes.
So he's out talking to prostitutes. He seems to have kind of a soft spot for prostitutes. No, he doesn't take advantage of them. He, you know, he says he's not going to, you know, I'd never bust him for... You know, prostituting.
Right.
The one that sells him the pills says, you know, I thought you were just going to take him. And he says, nah, I'd never do that. In fact, she says to him, you seem dangerous. He says, of course I'm dangerous. I'm police. I can do terrible things to people with impunity.
Well,
that was wonderful.
I love that line.
This highlights once we see Marty, because we didn't really see Marty's dark side in the first episode. Once we start seeing that Marty's not, you know, who he's really representing himself to be, what I liked was Cole comes off as more of an asshole and a jerk in a lot of ways, but he's honest and fair to everyone to the point where they really wish he wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. You know, can you treat me a little unfairly? It'd be nice.
Yeah.
And
the thing about Marty, too, Marty has a thing about, remember the scene where they went out to the bunny farm and the underage girl, and he was really upset about that?
Right.
She's not 18. He's the guy who... He'll beat somebody's ass for having sex with someone who's 17 years and 360 days.
Right, right.
But
right.
He'll fuck her on her 18th birthday.
Right, exactly. A week later.
Regardless of being married.
Yeah.
So anyway, they're still looking for... they hear about this bunny farm from the prostitute that Russ buys his drugs from.
Uh-huh.
They go looking for it, and these two poor guys, I mean, all they wanted was they went to night school to learn small motor repair.
Right.
And they go in, and they ask if they know where this bunny farm is. Nah, we don't know where it is. All right, thank you. Russ comes back, and he says,
oh, this is so cool. Yeah.
Now, we learn also that Russ knows Aikido.
Yes.
And There were a couple of other early indicators, like when they were in the locker room.
The locker room. Well, you know how my wife's pussy is supposed to smell?
Yeah. Which is another Marty trying to twist what they both knew was going on into something it wasn't.
Right.
He had been out with this young hottie.
Yeah, it's like, no, I'm not stupid.
Also foreshadowing.
Well, I can actually... I don't know if you were already planning on using this quote, but there was a quote from episode 2 that kind of rolled into my episode, but it says from Marty, saying, "Rust has as sharp an eye for weakness as I've seen."
Yeah.
The problem is he realizes that Cole can see him too.
Yeah.
Right.
And he don't like being seen. Right. He likes being slick.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep. And his bullshit works on everybody except it doesn't work on Rust.
Exactly.
Yeah. So anyway, they go into the lawnmower repair shop and they leave because they didn't get the information they want. Rust goes back in, and this is, you know, all martial arts have some variation of whacking a guy in the head with a toolbox. No, that wasn't. But what he did to the other guy was he took... And he started to throw him one way, and then he reversed that momentum and threw him on his back on the table. And that's Aikido. And then the handhold where he's holding his hand, what he's doing is he's digging his thumb into a nerve on the back of the hand, and it hurts like hell. And he will scream like a little girl. Marty was, when he was doing it to Marty was acting tough, like, you know, he wanted to scream. No, you scream and you don't care who sees.
Right.
It hurts that bad.
I bet it does.
So anyway, so Rust found out where the bunny farm is. They go see, they go find out, they get a box of stuff that belonged to Dora. And her yearbook is in there and also a diary. And that's where we start finding out about the Yellow King and Carcosa. And did... I didn't know what that was until the internets came up with, you know, it was a literary reference.
Yeah, I Googled that right away, you know. I didn't know what Carcosa was. And then I'm like, well, it can't be this story in their world, because he'll just find out about it.
Yeah.
Right, so, yeah, it's got to be that they're in one of these stories.
Yeah, okay, so we did find out about Rust. We talked about Rust's... his experience in the narco thing. He got shot 3 times. Everybody, all his old buddies that he was undercover with, his crime buddies, thought he was dead because he had disappeared after he got shot 3 times.
Did you catch the bit where, so Marty, he's got the underage girl there and he gives her $100 and says, go do something else.
Yeah.
And then Cole's like, what was that, down payment?
Yeah. It's like,
can you be more of a dick? But it
kind of turned out to be true.
It's also foreshadowing.
Exactly.
She had even better body than the first one.
There you go.
Oh, yeah.
Marty's got to talk about the eye for human weakness. He's got an eye for women.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, then they go, for some reason, they're at Maggie's parents, and you can tell that neither of them want to be there or like the parents. And Marty comes up. You know, Maggie's dad is one of these old-time conservative who looks like he's pretty wealthy.
Right. It's kind of interesting, because you would think that Mr. Good Old Boy Marty there would be like hemming and hawing it up with him. I actually was like, well, this is an interesting layer to Marty.
Yeah.
There is like something underneath.
Yeah.
Because he's rejecting this.
He was very progressive.
You know what's funny about that, though? The dad is saying, you know, the kids today, they wear too much makeup, and it's all about sex. That's exactly what happens to Marty's daughter.
Right.
So, kind of right.
Kind of right.
Well, they were sexualized early on. At least the older one was somehow. They were. Right. She was drawing the.
Well, that's one of the big things, and we actually have. I think it's in the next.
That was
cast.
Never really.
We have some questions. We have some questions about Audrey.
Yeah.
That'll that we'll cover in part 2. From our listener feedback. But
getting ahead of myself.
Sure.
Okay, and then I've only got just a couple of other really cool Rust quotes. Let's see. The hubris it must take to yank a soul out of non-existence into this meat. To force a life into this thresher.
Oh, he doesn't sound like a serial killer at all.
No, not at all. Meat thresher.
Or a fatalist.
He actually says at one point, well, maybe you have to quote about his daughter.
This is an important safety tip. When you're talking to the police about serial crime, try to avoid the phrase meat thresher.
Yeah.
And then these 3 guys get sent down from state or wherever.
The task force. This is Tuttle's task force.
Yes.
Tuttle's task force, and he's a dick to them, too. He says, Xerox all you want, boys. It'll make you feel like real cops.
Yeah.
Make you feel like good cops.
It's almost He's almost like an old-timey, sarcastic cop from a film noir.
Yeah.
Okay. Almost, yeah. Except, yeah.
I've been playing L.A. Noir, and there's a lot of dialogue like that. You know, James Ellroy stuff.
Mm.
Well, if you didn't, do you have anything else there? Because I think I had the only one.
You know,
there's another nice hallucination when, or maybe it isn't, when Rust sees the birds.
The spiral.
That's pretty awesome.
Are they starlings? Is that the birds?
I'm not sure.
That one really looks like what it looks like in a hallucinogen, because you see patterns that you don't normally discern, right? So, like, you'll look at something and see the negative space as the positive space or something weird like that. So you would totally see that interference pattern and interpret it as a spiral even if it wasn't.
Mm.
You know, and he's just like, oh, no, I know it wasn't real.
Yeah. Well, Nick Pizzolatto said that there's no surreal,
supernatural
stuff going on. So we're left to assume that it was another hallucination. And then they're in the burned out church. They finally, you know, they go looking for this church that this guy, Dora had started going to, and they end up in this burned out church. And
right.
See the picture on the wall of the, you know, with the antler lady. Boobs.
The only other details I got is we find out that he had a relationship with Lori that almost became a marriage. All right, so we know he had one relationship that we were first
now had. Is that the one that that Maggie introduced him to?
Yeah, the doctor.
But so we don't know. In the years after Dora.
Okay. Right.
And then and I have my Russ Cole quote was, she articulated a personal vision. Vision has meaning. Meaning is historical. What the fuck does that mean? And then Marty's like, what the hell?
Yeah, exactly.
Marty's like nodding. Okay.
Whatever.
All right, I think that's it.
Let's hit it a little more listener feedback, shall we?
Yes. And I want to apologize if you guys have heard little funny sounds. Tyrion, the new dog, is being a pain in the butt. But anyways, so this question was, what did you think of Maggie's story? The first one is Larkin Walken, who's out in Walnut Creek. Hi, neighbor.
Hey.
I didn't like Maggie, just on a sheer gut level reaction to her. She reminded me of another balls buster, Skyler from Breaking Bad. Didn't like her either. Both ladies struck me as being sanctimonious.
Both ladies are dealing with difficult situations. Maybe it's me, but I have sympathy for both of them.
I did too. I thought, like,
one's got a meth dealer husband, one's got a philandering husband who's lying.
In the terms of, like, if you're enjoying a narrative and you're like kind of projecting about how this bad boy can do all this crazy stuff, and you kind of fun fantasy is, oh, I wish I could get away with this shit.
Yeah.
So then the characters that speak reason, hey, we need you to, you know, not kill people.
Right.
Not cook meth. Yeah.
Or at least give us some account for where you're going for five hours at
maybe
a time.
Maybe,
you know,
have a job. You know.
Right.
You know. I don't really see that as ball busting.
No.
And certainly not for Maggie. I think there was less of that because it's not like Marty's doing these great adventures that we really want him to win on.
Well, we want to solve the case.
Yeah.
Yeah, we do. But I think he definitely.
But they're like the party poopers.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
But only in fantasy land.
Right.
In real life, they would make a lot of sense.
Yes.
Sure.
Kevin Sterling. She never bugged me one bit. Marty's a lecher who vowed he'd never cheat again. He comes home, washes his own clothes, takes a shower, and leaves his phone out in the open. What a dope. Maggie nailed Rust. Then nailed Marty to the wall. She exacted the perfect revenge. Marty was Maggie's third child.
I love that line. I made sure to.
Ah, yeah. That's good. Ouch.
Then Hannah Lovelace Paul. She was a smart woman who signed on to her marriage as a partner. And when Marty made it impossible for her to believe that they were still partners, she confronted him. No whining, just laid it out for him. She gave him every opportunity to be telling the truth, and the minute she found out he was lying the whole time, she did not whimper to her friends. She left.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
When Russ and Marty reunite in 2012, they didn't even bring her up until way into the conversation. And even then, she's basically dismissed by both men. There is no way she was the big betrayal between the two men. And I feel almost ashamed for Maggie that we got to see that and she doesn't even know. She was one of my favorite characters, even though I judge her pretty harshly for what she did to Rust. She had all the signs that Matthew pointed out above, but refused to hear what he was saying.
Yeah, this was in a thread. So.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she did use Rust.
Yeah.
And she was going to go right back to Marty and say, I fucked Rust.
Yeah.
So
that was dirty.
Kinda shitty.
That was really dirty.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But otherwise, I think she was very valid in everything she did and the way she handled herself.
It just, you know, if you're like getting off on the bad boy thing, it's like, oh, party pooper. Yeah. Barbara Richard. I think Maggie gets a lot of hate because, and this is not an easy admission, I felt territorial toward a wounded man. He asked her, what are you doing? And she said, to be honest with me. After all she said and done, the honesty she asked for was a duplicitous ploy at his emotional expense. I would be wise to remember that this was simply an 8-week run of make-believe and not people in real life. However,
that's true.
I think it's just about, you know, who the party pooper characters are, and they always tend to be women.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
It's sad because it really makes women look like such harpies, and they're not necessarily. Solange says, it seems to me that Maggie and Russ clicked, not necessarily sexually, but initially more empathetically. They were connected right away, 5 minutes in. In the mowing my lawn scenario, before Marty comes in and all gangbusters with jealous lawnmower rage, it was the first time in the entire series that we saw Russ with an open expression and anything at all resembling a smile or a glimpse of his tender humanity. All of Maggie's machinations to get Russ hooked up with her friends were in part wanting to see him healed, fulfilled, and also in her part living vicariously through those couplings. She felt connected to Russ in a profound way from the outset, and it was another way for her to connect. I utterly understand why she went for him for her revenge sex. She was so out of her mind, so desperate, but not enough out of her head to bang a stranger from a bar. Although I think if she banged a stranger from a bar, that would have been a little bit soft revenge.
And we have some good listener feedback.
Are they smart?
Yeah, these are some smart people.
You know, the lawnmower, the you mowed my lawn scene, as ridiculous as that is, it works in one of those that's overstepping your bounds. Yes. Especially when
this is my territory.
Have you guys seen the clip from Kingpin?
No.
It's Woody Harrelson, and he punches a guy out and says, you never mow another man's lawn.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so it's like,
where he had one hand.
Yeah, the one hand is the bowler. Yeah, So, anyway, sorry.
And Jackie Burgett, I felt that Rust was drawn to Maggie at first because she seemed easy to talk to, showed respect and compassion towards him without being patronizing. I don't think at first it was a sexual thing, but during the 7 years, they developed a bond, as it were. Rust's relationship with Lori must have been lacking somehow. Lori's vacant stare at TV, just going through the channels with the remote. Rust watching her, knowing there was an emptiness there. I would have thought at least one episode might give insight to their relationship.
Yeah, that was...
It was, yeah. There's actually a missing, a deleted clip where you see Lori and Rust break up and when it's over.
Oh, really?
That got accidentally released to the internet, so they've been taking it down. It's going to be part of the Blu-rays.
Okay.
But basically, it's over with kids. He doesn't want to have kids.
Because
the only time we see them together, they say how perfect they are together. So
did I you saw make that anything, somehow too.
Did you make anything of her being a doctor?
Definitely
intellectual equals.
Yeah,
intellectual
equals. She was really smart. Yeah. So
I mean, she had his number.
Yes, definitely.
Okay, I think we're about almost ready for episode 3. But first, let's get a little more sample of the show. And here we go.
And they saw in that last nanosecond, they saw what they were. You, yourself, this whole big drama, it was never anything but a jerry-rig of presumption and dumb will. And you could just let go. Finally know that you didn't have to hold on so tight. To realize that all your life, Not all your love, all your hate, all your memory, all your pain. It was all the same thing. It was all the same dream, a dream that you had inside a locked room. A dream about being a person. And like a lot of dreams, there's a monster at the end of it.
Ooh. I like that pulsing sound underneath.
Yeah, the sound design in the show was insane. Well, and then it goes insane.
Yeah, because that Inception Wong starts to happen. Yeah. Okay, well, I believe we have Miss Ekite.
So that was definitely a good roll-in, because the title of episode 3 is The Locked Room. The deeper Hart and Cole investigate the Dora Lang murder, the more we see Russ's ability to find and exploit defects in people.
Yep.
And Cole pokes and prods at the psychological failings of others, and we see this happen when he uses the language of faith to gently cause a sex offender to break down and be ready to confess to absolutely anything they tell him to. And then also when we see Hart losing his shit over Cole mowing his lawn.
Yeah.
So we're really seeing a lot of that going on this episode. And this episode to me is a lot of it is about neither of them practicing what they preach.
Right.
And, you know, Hart's hypocritical view on morality and Cole's nihilistic views on the world. And when we shoot from 95 to 2012, we see Cole before really wasn't living wasn't fully ready for that solitude life that he is now.
Right.
He's clearly living it now. Because we see, you know, although he, you know, is resistant to being around other people and like the family dinner and meeting girls and stuff like that, when he gets in that situation back in 95, then he does roll with it. And he's like, wait a minute, this isn't so bad. Whereas in 2012, he's just shut down and he's totally recluse or whatever, an old drunk. And my notes jump a little bit, sorry. And then they're also, in this episode, they're getting pressured to turn the case over to the task force. And Hart and Cole locate the pastor of the burnt down church, and the evangelist's name is Joel Theriot. And we learn Dora was often seen in the presence of a tall man with facial scarring. Mm-hmm. And Hart begins to reconnect with Maggie, but also, you know, goes and beats the crap out of Lisa's new boyfriend.
Before we get away from the Reverend, though, I want to point out this is something. So I had an article for IO9 deconstructing Cole, and part of it is about Reverend Theriot, mm-hmm. I guess. Mm-hmm. So on the show, you just see a couple of random lines that just seem like ordinary Jesus-y talk. But over at darknessbecomesyou.com and also on YouTube, they have the complete uncut version of that sermon. And it's actually a fairly complicated theological thesis that mirrors all of Cole's philosophy. So all of Cole's whole thing about, you know, time is a flat circle and you're trapped in eternity and you're going to live your life again and again and all this other stuff has this positive, those same ideas are expressed by the minister. Only he says, at the end of all of it, God will show you your true self, and all the sorrows of your life will make sense.
Right.
Mm. Right. And it foreshadows the ultimate ending that Cole has, you know, at the end of the show. But I highly recommend going and watching that because it's in the show, when you go back and watch it, because I was like, when I saw it online, I'm like, I don't remember all of this incredible talk. And then you go back and it's not there, you know. So got to see it online. Please go online and check that out.
Interesting. Cool. It's good.
Also, I like the cynical debate that the two characters have when they go into the revival meeting. That's pretty great, you know.
Safe to say nobody's going to be splitting the atom here, Marty.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's so mean, but it is funny.
She texts us up on your high horse.
Right.
Okay.
And then we also see Cole putting his insomnia to good use by spending long nights going through DB files for cases that are similar to Dora. Mm-hmm. And he stumbles upon Rhianne Oliver, and she was listed as an accidental drowning victim, but she has a lot of the same cuts and injuries and the tattoo and all that as Dora Lange.
Yeah.
But because it was at the same time as I think one of the hurricanes Andrew or something.
Yeah. Andrew.
They just put it down that she had drowned. And, you know, once you find a body and it's bloated, you can't really tell exactly what happened a lot of the time, too.
Oh, so they tested her for LSD.
Right.
That's, okay, now this is, oh, excuse me, bullshit.
Mm-hmm.
There's, to test for LSD, you have to test the spinal fluid, and you have to be looking for acid.
Mm.
And it's like you find some body in a river, you're not going to go testing it for LSD unless you have a lot of LSD tests lying around.
Yeah.
So anyway, but
yeah, you'd have to have a reason to be looking for it. So they go out into the bayou to meet with her grandfather, Rayanne Oliver's grandfather, and they find out that she attended the Light of the Way Academy, which is one of the schools that was run by Tuttle's organization. And then we find out she ran off with Reggie Ledoux. So they then head over to the closed school and they meet a man on the lawnmower there, and he's just a little too silver tongued and a little but then Hart, who's still in the car, gets a call and sends them in the direction of trying to find Reggie Ledoux. And
again, can I say, our group, you know, immediately when that episode is like, why did we spend so much time talking to the lawnmower guy?
Uh-huh. Right.
You know, everyone was like, he didn't give us any information, and we're walking back and forth. Even Marty's like, who walks that goddamn slow?
Yeah.
You know, right. And so it's like, clearly we're supposed to pay attention to Lawnmower Man, and he's not giving us anything really useful. So.
And when Marty's trying to get Cole's attention to get him back to the car, Cole, like, doesn't quite want to leave. He's just, something's not quite right here, and he just was a little unsettled.
Right.
But then that got him turned into another direction.
What's so ironic is he told the detectives, I have to have my big ledger so I can draw everything, because some detail's going to escape you. And then later on he says he missed the scars on this guy's face because he had dirt and a beard.
Yeah.
Right.
And see, it's like, if I had spent another 2 seconds looking, I might have noticed that your face was scarred.
Yeah. Right.
Right. Yeah. So they find out that Ledoux skipped parole, and he was a former cellmate of Dora Lange's husband, Charlie. So they go back and question Charlie again, and they put an APB out on Ledoux. And then, is there anything else major we want to cover here?
We'll get Audrey.
Yeah, there's
Audrey's picture.
Oh, yeah, Audrey.
Drama.
Audrey, yeah. So they have the situation with the older daughter of Marty and Maggie, and the drawings that she was making at school and the creepy Barbie doll stuff she was doing. And this whole part of the plot is just really frustrating with me because it doesn't really seem like it played out.
Right. And again, in our subsequent episode, we have our listener feedback on Audrey and that whole thing. And I think it was a weakness in the story that where it was a clear setup that was obvious how you could play it out. And then they didn't go there.
Right. Sure. I just don't understand why they wasted time doing all that.
And then, but the scene after that, where he puts down the book and then Maggie starts pressuring him, and we start seeing the way that Marty operates with his hustle. He deflects so incredibly.
Mm.
He's like a master at fucking bullshit.
Mm.
Right. And so she's like trying to pin him down. She's very vague too, the way she speaks. So you don't really know what she's talking about, or it's marriage talk. So you don't really know or whatever. Right. But then he starts spinning this line that no woman in her right mind would buy. Mm-hmm. I'm almost 40. I feel like the coyote. I'm gonna fall. I'm just trying to hold on. And it's just random generic.
That was
like
such bullshit.
Yeah. Well, it's like an artificially intelligent robot that's giving you a default reaction because it can't understand what you asked for. It's like, could you repeat that, please?
Yeah. I would have just wanted to look him in the eye and go, do you really believe your bullshit?
Well, she did say that to him before.
Yeah.
You know, but now she's looking at him like she bought the coyote line. They end up having, like, you know, Nicholas Rogue kind of sex with the close up camera.
Also, this scene makes Maggie unlikable in that she almost immediately blames him for what their daughter did with the drawings. Or sort of blames him. It's like, well, it's because you're not here. Really?
So there was that. Yeah. Other stuff to cover was...
Before I hit the last scene.
They have... Oh. Yeah, go ahead.
And then in 2012, we get a little more insight as to why the episode is titled The Locked Room. Because Cole says he's gained entry into the locked room that holds the secret to human perception, and is now convinced that inside is nothing more than a dream of being a person.
Right. That was the little audio they played. Dream of being a person. And then there's another bit I really liked where they're having the spring rolls. And they're talking about they've only got like 2 days left, and he's like, "Well, let's go digging through all the DBs and do all this." He's like, "We don't have the hours," and you're kind of myopic and a little obsessive. And he says, "Well, you're obsessive, right. Just not about the job."
Yeah.
And so we see the real friction between these two characters, and the personal level that's getting to. They're throwing back at each other's personal lives a little bit more.
And then my quote of the week I had found online, I thought was a good one. Somebody had posted was Marty. You know the real difference between you and me? Rust. Yeah, denial. Marty, the difference is that I know the difference between the idea and a fact. Mm-hmm. You are incapable of admitting doubt. Now that sounds like denial to me. Rust, I doubt that.
I doubt that. Yeah, that's the spring roll scene.
Yeah,
absolutely. And then we find out when he's talking to Lawnmower Man, we find out about the Tuttle School connection. I want to make sure that that's the Tuttle Schools. And the only other thing is we see Cole, Maggie sets him up with a girl. They go dancing at the bar.
Yeah.
And that's where
we see he acts like he preaches that he's, you know, like anti-human connection. Right. But when a human connection really reaches out to him, he snags onto it.
Oh, yeah. No, he protests too much, and Pizzolatto has said that.
In 95, in 2012, he doesn't, but...
Well, the girl...
he knew how to dance.
Yeah, but the girl that was his date, he hardly looked at her when he was talking to her. Even when they were dancing, he had his hand kind of on the small of her back, but his fingers were splayed back, so he wasn't, you know...
It was
really
awkward,
embracing.
Yeah.
He was kind of awkward. He wasn't looking at her. He was, you know, answering her questions, not really asking her anything.
But he definitely craves meaning and connection while deriding meaning and connection, I think. Absolutely. And I had one more thing here. Oh, yeah. You know, in that date, he's talking about synesthesia. So we know that he has synesthesia.
Yeah.
So he tastes colors and he smells music and stuff like that.
And did you notice she says, so if something feels good, it'll feel extra good?
Flirty.
Yeah, that got my attention.
And while that's going on, Marty's casing on his mistress.
Yes.
So.
Oh, yeah.
Was this the episode where we get the beat down on her? Yeah.
I think it is, actually.
Yeah, it's not episode 4. Yeah. He breaks into his girlfriend's apartment.
Right.
And beats up the boyfriend.
Right. I covered that.
And then he says, I don't do this, I'm not a psycho.
Right.
So that's when everybody on our board was like, oh, no, okay, it's not Rust, it's going to be Marty, for sure, because he beat somebody up.
Right. And then, you know, we have the final scene that we all think we're having Breaking Bad flashbacks, where we see what we later find out is Reggie Ledoux in his underwear and a gas mask walking through the grass
in
a bayou with a machete.
Oh,
Sasquatch.
And there's the most dreams have a monster.
Monster
at the end.
Yeah.
Right.
There he is.
Yeah.
Right.
That was pretty great. All right, I think we're just about ready to move over to episode 4, but we got a little bit more audio. Are we done with listener feedback? Did we get all the way through? Okay, good. All right, so we're done with that, so we're going to do a little audio. So,
audio's fun tonight. I like that.
Yeah,
I'm loving this audio thing.
We got a job to do. Off book. It's the only thing I can think of.
I got to straighten out things with the family. I got to fix it.
That bike club. I know them. I had deals with them when I was working Narco. We can get to that motherfucker, Ledoux. So, enough with the self-improvement, penance, hand-wringing shit. Let's go to work.
Do you think you're... Fuck! Hell of a bedside manner you got, Rust.
You know, being stupid is different than gone and sick, and this is a bar, not a fucking bedside.
Friend in need. Time I think you hit a ceiling, you just keep raising the bar. You are like the Michael Jordan of being a son of a bitch.
Come on, Rudy, I love this jacket I got.
And Marty's loving it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Marty's like, yeah, finally, someone's going to take me to some crazy shit.
All right, episode 4, man Andrew.
Episode 4 is Who Goes There? And I'm lucky enough to introduce what is probably the best episode, in my opinion, in the whole show. And certainly the most unusual, in that up to this point, the settings have been mostly Louisiana swamps and bayous, whenever they're in exteriors anyway. Mm-hmm. And here, suddenly, we're plunged into the inner city. And also, up to this point, most of the violence in the show has been brief, or it's just something, an aftermath. Here we get extreme violence. We get serious beatdowns and shootouts. So it's a very unusual episode. But and of course, it's notable mainly for the amazing 6-minute shot that comes at the end.
Oh, right.
We'll get to that shot. Later. Yeah. That's pretty incredible. Anyway, but it opens up with Charlie in jail. And here we, our two heroes go to interview him. And they find out about Reggie being his cellmate. And sure enough, Reggie was along with being a good drug chemist, was also talking about child satanic sacrifice and the Yellow King and had a spiral on his back. And then we hear the name Tyrone Weems, which becomes important. Mm-hmm. And they go to look for him. And actually, it's another nice character moment because Charlie was incredibly upset when he realizes that he was, by talking about his Dora to Reggie, he may have gotten her killed.
Right.
And Russ has no sympathy for Charlie.
And showing naked pictures of her to other people.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Well, but, hey, it's my wife. You know,
well, Marty calls him out on that, says, you didn't have to make him feel like it was his fault. He says, hey, he asked about himself first before he asked about her. Fuck him.
Yeah, that's true.
Because he asked about, are you going to get me, in front of a judge? And
right. Well, he's alive and Dora's not. I mean, we have priorities.
Anyway, then we see Marty testifying at a case. And, of course, there's Lisa, the court reporter, and also his mistress. They have an angry fight, and he, blows her off.
She says, you can't do this to me, Marty. You have to respect me. And he says, this is respect.
This is respect.
And then the elevator closes right in front of him, right? Yeah.
It's like,
And of course, elevators are symbols of hell. Whenever you see elevator in a movie, that's hell. So there's hell between these two. Anyway, go on.
Yes. Anyway, so back at the station, Rust and Marty tell all the officers about Reggie and Tyrone, and they're going to look. And eventually they find a woman named Kelsey, who's a stripper. So, of course, we have a scene in a strip club.
Right.
she says she doesn't know Tyrone anymore, but Marty pressures the bartender and finds out, they're still dating.
And the bartender is Nick. Is a lot of
right. That's kind of a key.
Wrote himself. Oh, it is. Yeah. I didn't know that.
He did not write himself in as the coroner.
And he Marty even says Harrelson even looks at him across the bar and goes, or something, some line about, I can't believe the things you make me say.
Well, he's gonna. He threatens to shut him down. Yeah. He's like, oh, do you want me to shut you down? Why do you make me say this?
Yeah. Why do you make me say this stuff?
That's like cliche cop dialogue.
Yeah. And it's so well done because there's all this tension.
I totally didn't get it.
Oh, rewatch it. You'll be laughing.
Well,
so hard.
I know the scene exactly. I didn't know it was Nick, though.
It's Nick, yeah.
And okay.
Kiss me, I'm an asshole.
Makes sense,
So then Marty comes home and finds his suitcases and a letter from Maggie. She's taken off. Turns out that Lisa called and told her, came over and told her everything.
And he not only gets home, he gets home and he has his I've been out fucking all night uniform on.
Right.
Tie untied around his neck, jacket half on. That's his look.
A guy like him would never do a load of laundry in his life.
Oh, no. Yeah.
Unless he was hiding cum stains from somebody he shouldn't have been doing.
Maybe. Yeah,
probably not, no.
And then we see in the interview he's trying to spin his family life to the two police officers. Right. Ah, well, these things.
I'm Captain America.
Yeah, exactly. And then...
my red, white, and blue tie.
So anyway, then he goes back to the strip club, follows the stripper, finds Tyrone, asks about Reggie, and he finds out that Reggie's with a bike club called the Iron Crusaders, and that he cooks meth for them. And he tells Rust. And then it's funny, in the interview with the two cops, Rust says, I needed personal time to see my dad. Of course, that was a long time ago.
Right. I can't really remember the details.
It's
one of the better moments where we know right away, they're totally lying. They're both totally lying to these guys.
They're both totally lying. And also that we've started to get this sense that they're suspecting Rust. Because he keeps saying, so he came up with the serial killer. So you kind of followed his lead on this. And it's like, okay, you're on to him. Why?
So Marty goes to talk to Maggie at work to try and get her to, take him back, and of course she doesn't even talk to him. Meanwhile, we get a great shot of Rust pulling out this locker he just happens to have in his room. And one of the things that cracks me up is he opens up and it has all these guns, and then he pulls out booze.
Yes. So,
yeah. Guns and booze guns together.
Guns and booze. You
know? Always a good time.
Oh, yeah.
But he has an AK-47 in there. That was that big gun with yes, a banana insane. Clip on it.
Oh, heavy anyway. Shit.
So
it's a little Halloween chest.
Russ comes to help Marty and says he has a line on Reggie. They go to a bar, and Rust is not sympathetic to Marty, as we heard in the clip. And Rust actually says at one point, that Lisa was crazy, and he says, all the dick swagger you roll, and you can't spot crazy pussy. Which
is a fair comment.
Some guys talk like that, not yes. me. But anyway, in what is a bit of a coincidence, but it's okay, it turns out that Rust knows about the bike club, the Iron Crusaders, from his undercover days.
Right.
And he shows Marty his gun stash, which is pretty funny. And then says that his cover is still good with the bike club. They don't know that he's actually a cop.
Right.
And says that he's going to meet him and he's going to make an offer, some kind of drug deal, get a line on Reggie. And then, of course, he says, we're going to do this just the two of us.
Yep. So, and that's the part where I was like, bullshit.
And he called it, we've got to do this off book.
Yeah, we're going to do this off book. Bullshit.
Well, you know what, though? This is another one of those cliches. Almost every cop movie and TV show has a moment when they're like, you know, what is it in Bad Boys? Shit just got real. You know, yes, always like, okay, we're not cops anymore. Yeah. This is personal. Yeah.
Verily, the feces becomes actual show. Here. Yeah.
They take a lot of liberties in this show, but it's so good you let them go.
Even
though they're rural cops in Louisiana, you can't do this shit. You can't just beat this crazy ass biker shit.
No.
You can't, you know, one cop isn't going to unlock the cell so that the other cop can beat the shit out of the two kids.
Yeah, I would hope. Yeah,
you have a whole career.
Actually, I can believe that more than I can believe
the
undercover
stuff. I believe some of that.
The beating the shit out of the two guys I could buy.
Not in county.
Maybe. I don't know. Anyway.
I don't know. But did you catch the bit where he's got Russ's jacket on and he opens it up and catches the bullet hole?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, so he's like looking at the bullet holes. So you know that Russ's story is not bullshit.
Yes,
yeah.
He was shot.
Or he shot his jacket. Probably.
and then scarred himself up.
Yes.
And Russ has a chilling moment where, you know, Marty's like, are you sure you want to do this? And Russ talks about how there used to be this drug cartel he knew that would tear someone's face off, put a mirror in front of you, and then cut your dick and balls off and shove them down your throat so you see yourself choking to death. He's like, death's better than that.
Shot in the head is not a problem.
Right, it's only shooting. And he literally starts injecting himself with ink and cayenne pepper to make his skin look contused. Hey.
Yep.
And then they have a funny scene where he goes to the evidence locker and very easily samples and steals some high-grade cocaine.
Oh, I loved how he's taught to, you know, take a snort.
You know, well, every cop show, too, the guy shoves a knife through the bag of cocaine and then just
like, walks off. There's no tape or anything.
Right.
Well, I love how he's sneaking the coke out and he actually says, we should have a better system for this. You know? It's like, even he... And then... in the interview in the modern day, we find out that his dad actually didn't really have leukemia. So the two cops are kind of onto him, you know. But he's like, oh, it was a long time ago. And then, Maggie and Russ actually meet and talk about Marty. And, Marty says he wants to see the girls. Russ kind of tries to make up for him. And then he has one of his more interesting moments. He's like, oh, you know, men and women don't work at all together except for having children.
Yeah. That's all we're good for. That's all that matters.
And then Maggie just like...
Then he gets his purpose then because she's done having babies.
Right. Exactly.
Well, they have to raise their babies.
Then she says to him, at the end of the day, you duck under rationalizations like the rest of them. You must have been a great husband, which is...
That was harsh.
See, again, they're making Maggie almost too much of a bitch, I think. So, anyway. Again, like in most cop movies and TV shows. So then we have a lovely shot of the bayou. And Russ tells Marty he's been around this club for a while. They're going to go to a biker bar.
The club, yeah.
And he gives him a cell phone a 1990s cell phone.
Right. Big old giant, you know, Gordon Gekko cell phone.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then there's an interesting moment where Russ tells Marty that Maggie's starting to softening and she'll take him back. And it's hard to tell if he's lying or not.
He's totally lying.
I think he's lying. Oh, he's totally just wants Marty's head in the game.
Absolutely, 100% lying.
Yeah.
But they do eventually get back together.
Yeah, no, but it doesn't mean he's wrong, but he's lying.
Yeah.
Okay. Because she didn't tell him anything like that, and he left her.
But she didn't say divorce, as he points out. She never did say the word divorce.
Okay, he's making it sound better than it is.
Probably. Right, yeah. Okay, fine.
He's sugarcoating it just to get him back in the game.
Because then they make a point of it. Marty's like, is that your honest read? He's like, that's my honest
read. Yeah,
yeah. Like, totally.
I think it's the only time we actually see Cole lie. I think. Aside from undercover stuff.
Yeah, yeah. I'm going to visit my dad with leukemia.
No. But in the relationship. In the
Oh, those two guys.
As characters. Yeah. He's lying about the cover-ups and those things, but not just a personal lie, a moment where he just lies.
Yeah, he just day-to-day, that's not his M.O.
That's not his M.O., yeah.
So anyway, so then they go to the very scary, shadowy biker bar where we see these slow motion shots of these huge, spooky bikers. It's a little over the top, I think, but I guess there probably are places like this. What do I know? Anyway, so he goes in to make a drug deal, and he meets Ginger, whom he used to know back in the day, who thought he was dead.
Right.
And they kind of bond. And he comes up with a nice cover story on why these... Mexican soldiers need the meth.
Right.
It's actually pretty smart. And Ginger, of course, likes the high-quality Coke. And but then he said he wants Russ to come with him on this raid they're going on. And Russ tries to get out of it, but Ginger's like, well, come on, you got to do this. What are you, a pussy now, the whole thing?
Right.
Usual macho thing. Meanwhile, Marty goes into the bar, looks completely out of place, makes a complete idiot of himself.
With a Pink Floyd t-shirt on.
Right, yeah.
I love Marty coming into the bar.
Well, also he's like, I'm his sponsor. He might go off the wagon.
He might go off the wagon.
Anyway, so then he goes back to the, Rust goes back to the biker's hideout.
Yeah.
And it turns out that they have this black drug dealer named Tiger from the projects. Hide in the closet, and they're going to force him to tell where his money is in the projects. And they have cop uniforms on, that'll work. Except, of course, Ginger has like a 10-foot beard, which is so not regulation. You know, come on. But they...
No, no, man. He's ZZ Cop.
Yeah. ZZ Cop. Yeah.
Now, I thought they were going to put the uniforms on Marty, because he... You know,
he
the cleanest
looks
cut
apart
them,
more. Yeah, that's, he does. Yeah. It would have worked better. But and it's funny because Rust is like, okay, so do we have a plan here? And they're like, well, not really. We got the uniforms. Fuck it. We got guns.
How are we getting out of there?
Yeah, it's just they're just really dumb. So yeah. It's like, oh great.
Yeah.
Anyway, so Marty's not sure what's going on. Then they grab Tiger and they go. And again, we're going into this urban setting, very different than anything we've seen on the show before. And then, of course, comes the very exciting shootout scene.
Yeah.
Where they go into the inner city, holding a gun to Tiger's head, pretending to be cops. They burst into the place. At first, it looks like it might work.
Right.
Amazingly. But then one of the bikers just randomly shoots one of the hostages.
Didn't you love how the sound goes out? Like, you hear this ringing and the volume drops.
Right.
Like it would if your ears are ringing.
And to show that Rust isn't a complete nihilist, one of the things he does is he sees that there's a kid playing video games in the house.
Uh-huh.
And he knows something bad is going to happen, so he takes the time to put the kid in the bathtub.
Right.
So he's like, stay here.
Then he pointed the gun right at the kid's face. Did you see that?
Oh, well.
He says, no, don't move.
Don't move, yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, I was emphasizing his point.
Well, he's going through it. He's Call of Duty-ing his way through it, so the gun is always right in front of you. There we go.
And then it's funny. It's totally believable somehow that Matthew McConaughey could be in the middle of this gunfight, get out of the house without getting hit, dragging
the only two white guys
in the neighborhood. Ginger along, right? The only two white guys in the neighborhood, dragging Ginger along, break into another house, get on the phone, call Marty, tell him to meet him at another place, still dragging
Helicopter.
Ginger. Helicopters and police everywhere, gunfire all around them, still dragging this dumb guy's ass, and they get in the car. at the end.
But yes. Then Ginger starts to get away, but no big deal. He just grabs him
right,
back.
Right, right. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, but
well,
it
there's nowhere for Ginger to go.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah,
he's probably
point.
Safer with Marty than he is with,
he
or
is,
with Russ.
Yeah.
Than
so
Ginger's in trouble. So.
Whether you want to believe these things or not, there's a couple of legendary elements to this. First of all, it is all one big take. They shot with cuts. They did multiple takes, but there's no point where they broke and then did a reset up.
Right.
It's one run through multiple times.
And that's pretty rare in television.
And the thing is, according to Pizzolatto or the director, I forget which, it really is a public housing development. They use real projects, and they could not take down that fence. It was against government regulation to take down the fence. They had to climb over it. So they built a whole jib rig for the cameraman so he could step up and get jibbed over the fence.
Oh, wow.
And they did not have that planned until they got that notice. It's like, because they were going to just knock down the fence and run through it. He says, no, you got to leave the fence up. So they had to build a platform jib for a steady cam rig.
Wow.
How cool.
Yeah, it's super sexy.
Yeah.
Enormous amount of
Now, they could be bullshitting us with that. This could be a war story, but it's a good war story.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
And the episode ends with Rust getting Ginger into the car and demanding that he give up Lido. And there's a nice helicopter shot of this just completely chaotic neighborhood as behind them.
And Rust pistol whips Ginger.
And pistol whips
Ginger. Yeah, well, Ginger suddenly becomes Rust's bitch, for the rest of the show. So. Yes.
So when this episode aired, Jay Greenspan, who's on our board, he's a friend of mine who's a media developer and this kind of stuff. He's very into the show. He liked it. And he and I think Shane as well. We should shout out to Shane Bowman, who's not feeling well.
Poor Shane.
Poor Shane. He was going to be with us tonight, but he's not feeling well. So
should we tell what happened to
Shane?
Him?
No, I think we shouldn't be private about what happens to people. It's nothing serious, but he's not feeling well. Anyway, Jay and I think it was kind of Shane as well were kind of like, well, I thought that this show has been so sort of slow and languorous up to now, and suddenly we have this action scene that seemed to come out of nowhere, and it kind of broke the rhythm for me, and I was sympathetic to that until we find out what happens with the Reggie Ledoux thing. They've been building to that action scene, and they weren't going to give it to us. So you got to get an action scene. Otherwise, they're going to be ripped off.
Yeah.
Right. So, I was thinking, like, now next week we're going to have a big shootout, and then the week after that it's going to be a helicopter chase or whatever, right?
Right.
And it's like, no, I'm depriving you of an action scene that I'm promising, so I'm going to give you one that I didn't promise.
Yeah.
Anyway.
And like I said, it's uncharacteristic of the rest of the show, which I thought was interesting.
Yeah.
Jarring.
Really?
Yeah.
It's very jarring.
First time I saw it, I'm like, whoa, they're going where?
Yeah.
But it was very good, I thought.
So, yeah, amazingly coordinated. Anything else from anybody else?
Very good.
So this is the end of part one, and please join us in a couple days for part two, where we will be covering episodes 4 through 8. And until then, just start asking the right fucking questions.